From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Last night, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama duked it out in one more debate. We're going to talk a little later to people who can put what they said in perspective, but first, we are digging into one of the biggest national and international issues, the mortgage crisis. Thousands of homeowners have mortgages greater than what their homes are worth. A new bill aims to change that, but at what expense to the economy? With us, we've got Melissa Harris-Lacewell, a professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton, and Robert Trainum, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. He's at our NPR headquarters in Washington. Hi, folks.
Hi, Farai.
So, Robert, let me start with you. The bill aims to ease the strain on borrowers, reducing their payment obligations to the market price of their home. That could be good news for folks who've got mortgages, but is it going to be good news for the economy? What do you think?
Well, you know, you're right. It's good news potentially for the homeowners, but it's not so good news for the lending associations out there, where candidly speaking, they're going to say, well, wait a minute. You took out this loan for a certain amount. Now, regardless of what your house is worth, this is how much you owe us. So it's not so good for the economy overall, because most financial individuals would say, you know what, we need that money to go back into the economy. We need people to be in debt to a certain degree so that that fuels the economy. Republicans also in Capitol Hill, Farai, are also balking at this. And candidly speaking, I'm not sure this actually has enough steam to pass the United States House and the United States Senate.
Melissa, first of all, what do you think of the proposal? And secondly, do you think it's going to pass?
Ultimately, I actually think that this is not a good proposal. I'm one of those people who really hates the story of the prodigal son, where the guy gets to go out and make a mess, and when he comes back, the father kills a fatted calf for him and makes happy.
you're just bitter.
I am a little irritated, actually, because, of course, there are many things that we invest in which could, in fact, lose value. Everything from our stocks and bonds to, let's even say it, our college education.
And not to mention that big screen TV.
Right. I mean, plenty of things in which that we take out debt for which are worth less after we bring them home, everybody's new car that they're driving, right? But we actually don't correct that by going through and changing your level of indebtedness. You are indebted on the day that you sign the contract. And I think there are very real reasons why we don't want to engage in a circumstance where we're telling lending institutions that the government's going to come in or allow judges to come in and shift that accountability. I think that's exactly not what we want. Now, there are real things the government can do to provide relief, but I think that this is a bad idea.
May I touch on that for a second?
Mm-hmm.
It actually also sets a very, very bad precedent for judges, where they can say, well, you know what, we did it for this case, we should do it for this case. It creates a slippery slope where many Republicans on Capitol Hill say, you know what, enough is enough. She is exactly right, where, you know, you have an obligation, regardless of whether it's a good obligation or a bad obligation, to repay your debt, regardless of how much that is. And a lot of folks on Capitol Hill are saying, well, wait a minute here. We are all you should be responsible adults, number one. But also, number two, there is a sense of responsibility that's on your part where you have to pay that debt back regardless of how much you owe.
But let me put it in this context. Robert first and then Melissa. There are things called corporate write-downs. There are ways for corporations to deal with losses in the short term and mid-range that regular human folks don't have. Is it a case of saying, well, okay, we're doing a write-down here and letting the chips fall where they may?
Yes and no. I mean, the only other good thing about this is that regardless of how much in debt you are with your house, traditionally, you always get your return back on your house. Now, you may not get that return back in the next 5 or 6 or 7 years, but over the lifespan of your mortgage, whether it be 20 or 30 years, you typically get your money back in some way, shape, or form. So it's slightly different, although I see your point, Farai.
Melissa?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I don't think we solve the problem of corporate welfare or of, you know, the sort of corporate buyouts by then extending bad policy to broader groups. In fact, I think we simply should draw back some of the ways in which we undergird corporations, which also fail to live up to their debt burdens. Now, I'm not saying that no one should intervene, that everybody should just take their loss and, you know, go on about it. But part of what happened here was the ways in which the unregulated market or the deregulation of the market allowed a kind of gaming system for those who were providing mortgages, so that many people ended up in mortgages that they simply should never have been in from the beginning. If instead we look back at kind of a post-World War II model, where what we did was make housing more affordable by providing a variety of subsidies to get families into homes that they could actually afford. Yes, it reduced a profit margin, but it created a more stable circumstance in which we now have people who are in their fourth generation of profiting from those early FHA homes.
Let me move on to something else more election-related. Senator Christopher Dodd threw his weight behind Barack Obama this week. The senator from Connecticut pulled out of the presidential race after the Iowa caucuses, and he's worried that the Democrats are taking too long to pick a nominee. He basically says if the nomination goes on too long, the Democrats are going to infight and lose. Melissa, do you think that that's a real risk?
Well, I certainly think it's a real risk to imagine that the Democratic Party can certainly win this election. They might win it, but this is in some ways the Republican Party's election to lose, even though it seems like how is it possible that John McCain could beat either one of these two, people who are still standing, either Clinton or Obama. So I do think that Dodd's right, that now is time to start thinking about questions of the electability of the candidate as well as kind of what's good for the party in a broader sense. This not just a presidential election year. We are also voting for the U.S. House of Representatives, for a third of the U.S. Senate, and extremely importantly, for the state houses, state legislatures, and governorships, which will be critical for redrawing in 2010, during the time of the census, redrawing these districts. It can't be just that our candidate wins. It's got to be that the whole party wins.
Robert, when you take a look at Senator Dodd, he's also a superdelegate. Is that going to have any influence, his decision to support Obama, on the other superdelegates, or even just his question about whether or not the Democrats are going to set themselves on fire?
Yes. He not only is a superdelegate, but he also is a former chairman of the DNC under the previous Clinton administration. He's an elder in the party. He is a senior senator from Connecticut. He has been around the block more than once. He is exactly right. All of my Republican friends are telling me that they are just salivating at this fight on the Democratic side, where literally they have popped open, the soda pop and popped some popcorn, because this is an absolutely fascinating conversation that the Democrats are having amongst themselves, as opposed to you go forward with hope and change with Senator Obama, or do you go with experience with Senator Clinton? Senator Dodd is exactly right. If, in fact, this continues to go on, to use Howard Dean's terminology, he'll have to probably bring both sides into a room so they can actually hash this out before a brokered convention, because it looks like that's exactly where this is going.
Well, what about the Republican side? Senator McCain was, he wasn't always a shoo-in. He was struggling for a while, and he actually applied for federal funds. Instead of actually taking them, he used it as collateral so that he could have his own money. Now the Democrats are basically beefing, and they want the government to see if McCain exceeded his spending limits. This is all about campaign finance law, and Senator McCain has been in the middle of it as a legislator. Do you think he's broken any rules, either legally or morally?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because from a legal standpoint, it appears that Senator McCain has not broken any laws. From a moral and ethical standpoint, that's a different story. Senator McCain has always backed all of his candidacies for the presidency when he ran him back in 2000, also when he ran for the United States Senate for reelection, on this premise, if you will, that he is better on the issues when it comes to campaign finance reform. My goodness, he is the one who authored campaign finance reform back in 1998 with Russ Feingold. So this is a very interesting dilemma that he's in, at least from a rhetorical standpoint, although Senator Obama, to be fair, also said that if, in fact, he was going to be running for president, this was 8 months ago when no one thought that he would have a shot at the Democratic nomination, that he would also accept public financing. And now it appears that Senator Obama is reneging on that promise. So, there's a little bit of he said, she said there, and to use Senator McCain's words, there is some Washington doublespeak on both sides.
What's really the impact? I mean, when we talk about financing, Melissa, there's been a lot of question of whether the U.S. should move towards a model more like other nations where there's more public financing, including for advertising, which is really the biggest expense in these campaigns. How does Senator Obama, as well as Senator McCain's position, really reflect on what we're doing as a country in terms of supporting the candidates to run a clean, fair election?
Well, I think there's two interesting things here. I mean, this point is exactly right, that McCain and Obama are, if they end up running against each other in the general election, are actually going to be competing for who can run the cleanest campaign, because both of them have sort of set themselves up as different from traditional partisans, cleaner, fairer, all of those kinds of things. So it'll be fascinating to watch them throw mud about who's less clean. It'll be fascinating to watch. But I think this question of financing goes to the heart of the kind of question of, you know, our democratic politics with a little d. Will we actually be able to cultivate a leadership base that looks more like the American public? Has everything to do with our campaign financing. We know that, for example, the reason that women are largely shut out of office from dog catcher to the Senate has everything to do with their inability to raise large amounts of money, not necessarily with their qualifications as a candidate. We know that one of the reasons that African Americans have been largely centered in predominantly black districts is they find it difficult to raise the money necessary to run statewide campaigns. When black candidates who are highly effective do in fact get the money, people like Deval Patrick or in this case now Barack Obama, they actually are competitive. So, you know, our ability to have a more diverse and a more fair democratic political system has everything to do with making it cheaper to run for all of these offices. And again, really, dog catcher to the White House, it's not just a problem at the top.
Robert, very quickly, do you think that more public funding is a good thing and more candidates taking it is a good thing?
Overall, I believe it is, simply because you have much more transparency. You know exactly where the money is coming from. You know exactly who's giving it. It also, frank, candidly speaking, gives everyone an equal playing field. Will we ever get there? I don't think so.
Robert and Melissa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Melissa Harris-Lacewell is a professor of politics and African American studies at Princeton, and Robert Trainum is the D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. He joined me from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Was it play nice in last night's debate between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, or more like Rock'em Sock'em Robots? They were in Cleveland, Ohio, and this was the last chance the Democratic candidates had to face each other before the big contests in Ohio and Texas. To break down the state of play, we've got Kalila Brown-Dean. She's the Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Yale University. Plus James Taylor. He's an Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of San Francisco. Kalila, James, welcome. Welcome, guys.
Thank you.
So we've seen 20 presidential debates so far with Clinton and Obama facing each other one-on-one three times. Did we learn or hear anything new from either Democratic candidate?
After 19 debates, it's difficult to conceive of any new information coming from these debates. But what I think we did learn more about during this particular debate is that Hillary Clinton is really on the offensive right now. She seems sort of tense during the debate, attacking Senator Obama or attempting to, but I don't think we had any real substantive knockouts here.
What do you think, James?
Well, I think Khalil is right that there was not a whole lot of new territory covered. I do think that Barack Obama's sort of management of the issues related to Iraq forced Hillary Clinton to all but apologize for her vote in 2002. So we did see some movement in that direction. And I think we also saw Barack Obama sort of clarify that his position on Pakistan, which everyone sort of thought was naive foreign policy, actually was validated by the current administration's recent actions in that area. So in those two areas, I do see some new material that was presented in last night's discussion.
Kalila, let's listen to a little bit of Hillary Clinton, who said that she often gets asked the first question in debates.
Well, can I just point out that in the last several debates, I seem to get the first question all the time. And I don't mind. I'll be happy to field them, but I do find it curious. And if anybody saw Saturday Night Live, you know, maybe we should ask Barack if he's comfortable and needs another pillow.
What was that all about, Kalila?
Well, you know, Senator Clinton has said numerous times that she feels that the media has been biased in favor of Senator Obama, that they sort of coddle him and treat him very differently, that she feels that she's been attacked. And I think she was expressing that in the debate last night. I think, however, that there was a way to express that concern that would have been more effective than the comment. It seemed a little awkward to say, you know, I keep getting the first question, the very difficult questions, but I'm happy to answer them. So in some ways, that that contradicted the point that she was trying to make.
James, I was talking to a black female elected official, who shall remain nameless, who said that Hillary Clinton is sounding shrill and was embarrassed about it in a way. She said, I don't want to make a woman, you know, say that a woman sounds shrill, but she does. Is that something that you vibe with, or is that, you know, out of bounds?
Well, I think there's a lot of a sort of misogynistic feeling out there where men probably do sort of wince at, you know, Hillary's laugh that has gotten a lot of attention lately, and her voice intonations when she sort of completes a sentence and rises to the climax when she crescendos. I think, you know, I've heard people say things that I thought are somewhat misogynistic and say that it's nail biting or like the blackboard being scratched. But, again, a lot of these issues that I think were discussed last night, I think they missed out on tremendous opportunity to talk about sort of more important issues, including, for example, the devastating housing industry. That was not discussed for 1 minute, but they talked 16 minutes about a hypothetical health care plan that doesn't even exist right now.
Let's listen to a little bit of back and forth the candidates had with each other regarding Louis Farrakhan's support for Barack Obama.
There's a difference between denouncing and rejecting. I just think we've got to be even stronger.
I don't see a difference between denouncing and rejecting. There's no formal offer of help from Minister Farrakhan that would involve me rejecting it. But if the word reject, Senator Clinton feels, is stronger than the word denounce, then I'm happy to concede the point.
You say denouncing and I say rejecting. Denouncing, rejecting. Anyway, is there a difference, James?
I don't see a big difference. I think Obama tried to distance himself. And I think what really sort of needs to be discussed is the ways in which, over the past 25 years, African-American elected officials, from Tom Bradley to David Dinkins to Harold Washington to Barack Obama, have had to sort of use Farrakhan as a litmus and as a way of sort of explaining how they would be towards, say, Israel or sort of, you know, issues of anti-Semitism in America. Barack Obama is in no way, shape, form, or fashion associated with Farrakhan, except through his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, but that's not Barack Obama's own personal relationship. William F. Buckley just died today. Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, is in the hospital. John Danforth is hospitalized. Jeremiah Wright, Louis Farrakhan, John McCain, Andrew Young, they all represent a passing generation, and that Barack Obama is something new. So he has nothing to do with these old wars and conflicts.
I've even heard, though, some people say, Kalila, that there should be a situation where Senator Obama should resign from his church because his pastor has given an award to Minister Farrakhan. Do you think that he has to go all the way there?
I think it's definitely unnecessary for him to do that. I think Senator Obama has said before that he is led by God, not led by man. And so to assume that because he worships in this church assumes that they share the same views, that everyone in that congregation agrees with the minister, in many ways, to me, undermines Senator Obama's intelligence. I think he said very pointedly last night that he did not agree with the views of Minister Farrakhan, that he had spoken out previously about anti-Semitism within black communities, and that he would continue to do so. I think he captured the moment when he said he really wants to restore that historic coalition between black and Jewish voters. And that was a way for Senator Obama to address the critique that Tim Russert posed, but to also talk about moving forward, to move past those historic wounds and battles that Professor Taylor just spoke of.
Senator Clinton also, in her closing remarks, arguably played the gender card. Let's listen to what she had to say.
Obviously, I am thrilled to be running to be the first woman president, which I think would be a sea change in our country and around the world, and would give enormous, enormous hope and, you know, real challenge to the way things have been done.
Kalila, the H word, hope, played there. Do you think it's going to work?
I think at this point it may be a little too late for her, but I think it's also important to recognize the very sophisticated and subtle ways that gender has operated throughout this primary election cycle. From Senator Obama saying to, you know, referencing Senator Clinton, we haven't whined about those attacks, to me, is a very gendered statement. The way that people refer to Senator Clinton by her first name, as if they are, you know, girlfriends headed to the nail salon, says a lot about the importance of gender in this election. Does it mean that gender no longer matters? Does it mean that we've overcome that? Certainly not. But I think that it's a little too late for Senator Clinton to really offer that as, you know, hope for the future.
James, I want to take us, before we break this off, to another topic. Senator John McCain was in a situation where he had an event in Ohio, and there was Bill Cunningham, a radio host, who called Obama a hack Chicago-style daily politician and addressed Obama by his full name, Barack Hussein Obama. Let's take a listen to that. So Barack Hussein Obama was the phrase that was used over and over again. And there was a situation where McCain said he was told about the disparaging remarks while backstage and immediately apologized, saying he repudiated the comments. Today, Bill Cunningham said he had it with John McCain. He's joining Ann Coulter in supporting Hillary Rodham Clinton. Yeah. So is this a situation where the conservatives basically are, you know, they're saying, unless you go with us all the way to Barack Hussein Obama, that we're not going to roll with you?
Yeah, I think Barack Obama, this is really good for him. I think this is actually a blessing in disguise, that this is being done and outed and vetted now in this primary process. It really deflates its sting, potential sting, in the general election. So I think the fact that someone sort of, you know, used this sort of vitriol, deliberately coded sort of racism on one level, and clearly religious, I would say religious sort of stigmatism on another level, to try to associate Barack Obama with Islam, this actually is a good thing to let it happen now rather than it happening in the general election, so that now everyone can see how they'll respond to it. We'll see how the country will respond. We'll see how Texas and Ohio will respond, and the ways in which Barack Obama handled it. So cool, calm, and Kennedy-esque. Just, I think, is, again, a credit to his reaction, is that he didn't get caught up, his campaign didn't get caught up in reacting to this. And this is going to continue to come from Bill O'Reilly talking about lynching his wife, from Rush Limbaugh. And this is going to happen to John McCain as well as Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton.
All right. We're going to have to wrap it up there, but lots to talk about. James Kalila, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
James Taylor is an associate professor of political science at the University of San Francisco. He joined us from the studios at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. And Kalila Brown Dean is the Peter Strauss Family Assistant Professor of Political Science and African American Studies at Yale University. She spoke with us from the studios at Yale. You guys have been blowing up our blog with comments about the photo firestorm involving Barack Obama. And our web producer, Jeffrey Bennett, has more on the battles on News and Views. Hey.
Hey there, Fry.
So he might look good in a head wrap, but that does not change the political calculus. The Obama campaign, there's pictures. Hillary Clinton's camp is accused. He's wearing basically just a little ethnic garb.
Right.
What's the problem?
Well, the problem is, at least in our blog, that people aren't buying the Clinton campaign's denial of being involved. People on our blog used words like dirty tricks and silliness to describe the leaked photo. A reader using the name Mr. Anton wrote, "The picture is intended to make people question whether or not he's Muslim." But Joan Warren, another reader, saw it this way. She wrote, "I think it's incumbent upon voters to rise above this kind of distraction." The responses from both campaigns, reaction from our readers, and the photo from his trip to Africa that we're talking about is on the front page of our blog right now, so people can go and check it out.
So we also covered the president's trip to the continent of Africa. What's been the response on the blog?
Well, you know, all sorts of video and photos of President Bush dancing and making nice with the locals in Africa are all over the web. On our blog, we talk specifically about what his Africa legacy would be. The blogger DJ Black Adam wrote on our site, "Dare I say his record will be better than that of our first so-called black president, Bill Clinton. However, his administration has done nothing regarding Darfur. Overall grade, F+, in contrast to Bill Clinton's F." So some tough words there.
What else is getting traffic on the blog?
It's all over the board, really. People are talking about a new study showing how Americans are increasingly exploring different ways of worship. So we talked about religious identity. Folks are also talking about how some Ivy League schools are reducing and in some cases waiving tuition. And we also talked about Whoopi Goldberg feeling snubbed by the Oscars when she was left out of a video montage.
Well, thanks, Jeff. And of course, we want people to post at will.
That's right.
Jeffrey Bennett is the web producer for News and Notes, and he joined me in our studios at NPR West. And we've got our bloggers on the case. The Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan praises Barack Obama, and internal struggles at the NAACP threaten the group's future. With us, we've got Wayne Bennett. He's an attorney who blogs as The Field Negro. Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfauntroy.com. And Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So let's talk about Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam. At an annual celebration in Chicago over the weekend, he praised Barack Obama. He talked about how, you know, in his words, we are witnessing the phenomenal rise of a man of color in a country that has persecuted us because of our color. And he also compared Obama to the Nation of Islam founder, Fard Muhammad, who also had a white mother. Here's what he said.
A black man with a white mother could turn out to be one who can lift America from her fall.
Obviously a little faint there, but he said that a black man with a white mother could lift America from her fall. You know, what do you think about that, Deborah? That, you know, decoding of the racial coding, first of all.
Well, I think this has everything to do with Minister Farrakhan trying to rehabilitate himself and trying to regain, trying to gain some sort of mainstream legitimacy. If he really was on Barack Obama's side, he wouldn't say anything about him. So I think that's the first thing you have to look at. I think that's about Minister Farrakhan, you know, as his days start to dwindle down. He's had some health issues. You know, he's apologized about Malcolm X. I think this is primarily about that. And I think there's a sort of recklessness there. I'm fascinated. I read about it, but in hearing him, this is off topic, but I'm fascinated about how a white woman could have a black child, but black women can only have black children. You know, I just that, you know, Asian women can only have Asian children. I just think that's really, really interesting. But I think it also flies in the face of the rhetoric and the beliefs of the Nation of Islam up to this point, given Barack Obama's politics, which really have to be anathema to this whole transcendent, non-aggressive, not blaming and not requiring apologies and this not in your face kind of stuff. I'm not an adherent of the Nation of Islam, but I got to say I'm a little embarrassed for them. I think this is embarrassing for them.
All right. Well, there's a lot there, and we're going to have to talk. We're planning to talk about identity some other time. We've only got a little bit of time, but we're going to come back later. Wayne, what do you think? Is this a statement that is designed, as Deborah says, to rehabilitate the image of the Nation of Islam?
I certainly think he is thinking about his legacy as an African-American leader. I do think I agree with her that it really didn't help Barack Obama. I don't know if it was intentional or not. I think he was just really saying how he felt at the time about the movement. I think she's right in that, you know, it's kind of, you know, he's getting on the bandwagon a little late. And being from Chicago like Barack Obama, I think adds a little more interesting sidebar to the dynamic. I'm not too sure of their relationship. I know I saw where Barack Obama denounced him strongly in the debate. And I was a little bit surprised about that. But no, I agree with her for the most part that it's hurting him more than it's going to help him, and him meeting Barack Obama. And I just thought it was kind of interesting. Yeah.
Well, you know what? We're going to talk more about that after a break. I'm going to ask you guys to stay with us. We are talking the Bloggers Roundtable, Wayne Bennett, Deborah Dickerson, and Michael Fauntroy. We're also going to talk with Sudhir Ventakesh, who spent 7 years with Chicago's notorious Black Kings Street Gang. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We are back with our Bloggers Roundtable. We've got Wayne Bennett, an attorney who blogs as The Field Negro, Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfauntroy.com, and Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com. So welcome back, folks, and we're talking about Minister Farrakhan. At last night's debate in Ohio, moderated by NBC's Tim Russert, Obama responded to the support he got from Minister Farrakhan.
I obviously can't censor him, but it is not support that I sought.
Do you reject his support?
Well, Tim, you know, I can't say to somebody that he can't say that he thinks I'm a good guy. I have been very clear in my denunciations of him and his past statements.
Michael, Minister Farrakhan has been a bit of a third rail in racial politics. How should Senator Obama have played his cards? I mean, he's going to definitely tick off some people who don't want him to appear to kowtow to mainstream opinion.
Farai, it's as if you were reading my mind. You know, Farrakhan is radioactive even after all these years. And I think that the controversy around these comments sort of underscores all of that. And as I see it, you know, Barack Obama, in my opinion, has been allowed to run a deracialized campaign, which I completely understand, given the nature of American politics. But at some point, he's going to have to deal with some of the uniquely the issues that are of unique importance to African Americans. And unfortunately for him, this whole controversy with Farrakhan sort of makes it a bit more difficult for him to do that on his terms.
Deborah, let's talk specifically about some of the issues around Minister Farrakhan. Specifically, you know, allegations that his rhetoric is baldly anti-Semitic. How do you fall on that?
Well, first of all, to the sort of basic political point, I think Senator Clinton thought she was playing a winning hand, and I think Barack Obama handled it perfectly. I think she lost on that one. She called his she gave him an ultimatum and he called her bluff. So I think he handled it consummately, and she made him look kind of silly. Denounce, reject, potato, potato. You want me to say reject? Fine, I reject. So he called her bluff. I thought he handled it perfectly. I am not up on what Minister Farrakhan has said in the last year or two, but I don't think that anything he said in the last year or two can undo, you know, a near generation of unconscionable rhetoric. I don't think, you know, short of some major, you know, public apology and sort of ritual communistic type, you know, self-criticism, I don't know what he could do to undo what he has done with the political stance as his leader of the Nation of Islam. So I couldn't say how it squares with what he's done lately, but I will say that I don't think there's anything he can undo the legacy that he created for himself.
Wayne, I'm going to get to you in a second, but Michael, sure. you wrote an article called What Should Black America Expect from a Black President? Does it touch on these issues of identity at all and on, you know, kind of basically, is this our guy or is this not our guy?
The article, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, we are a country of identities. And the point that I've been trying to make throughout this campaign is that rather than try to act like these identities don't exist, we ought to embrace them. You know, we respect each other's differences, but we embrace the uniqueness that exists within each different type of American. And so the point that I'm trying to make is there are issues that are universal that everybody seems to agree on are important, you know, Iraq, taxes, housing, healthcare, that sort of thing. But there are also issues that are of unique importance to individual groups within the subculture of America. And so you would have Latinos, for example, who are much more interested in immigration than many Americans. You have Jews, for example, who are much more interested in Middle Eastern and Israeli policy than other Americans. And there are issues that are of unique importance to African Americans. And so the point that I made in that column is I think now at this stage, given that he is the front runner with the most votes and the most delegates and all the momentum, and quite frankly, more likely than anybody else to be the next president of the United States, I think it's all right to test the notion that the country is falling in line and unifying behind this guy by talking about some issues that don't often get any attention.
Wayne, what do you see ahead for the general election? If, and it's still an if, Barack Obama is the Democratic nominee, how are the Republicans, you think, going to play their card on race?
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I'm always leery of what I call the Bradley effect. If the polls, Rasmussen, USA Today, whatever, if they say Obama is 10 points up, it's even. If they say he's 10 points down, he's 20 points down. So you always have to be leery of these polls when you're talking about a minority candidate. I think it's going to be very rough in the general. I know John McCain took the high road with the gentleman Cunningham yesterday, but I think his people in that movement are just not going to let Barack Obama, they're just not going to give him the ring. I mean, they're going to, you see now we're hearing his middle name more and more. We saw him in that the Somalian elder's garb on Drudge, of all places. And I think it's just going to get very ugly before it gets any better. So I don't know if he's going to, I'm not ready to say he's going to win it yet. I think it's going to be very tough. And I think he's done a very good job. I have to give it to him so far. And I
that's, may I add something to that quickly, please?
I'm going to move on.
Okay.
I'm going to use my hostly prerogative.
Okay.
We have one slight topic, and this is a speed round. I'm going to make you thumbs up or thumbs down. Last year in July, we spoke with NAACP Chairman Julian Bond. Before I explain what we're going to, let's hear what he said.
The fact is that if any organization precipitously loses its top official, then there's some moments of turmoil within the organization, and we certainly experienced some measures of turmoil, but we're on the road to recovery. We've got our fundraising apparatus in place, and I feel quite confident that within not the immediate future, but say 6 to 9 months, we'll be back on solid ground once again.
They don't have a leader yet. It's been months, and this is a thumbs up, thumbs down. We don't have much time. I'm going to go through each of you. Will the NAACP have any impact on this election, Wayne?
Thumbs down.
Michael.
No, none.
Michael.
Down.
Deborah.
Down.
All right. Well, you got the word on that. We could talk about it more, but we don't have time right now. This is our Bloggers Roundtable. Thanks, guys.
Thank you,
Brian.
We've been talking with Deborah Dickerson, author of the books An American Story and The End of Blackness. She blogs at motherjones.com, and she was at member station WAMC in Albany, New York. Also, attorney Wayne Bennett, who blogs as The Field Negro. He was at the Audio Post Studios in Philadelphia. And Michael Fauntroy, assistant professor of public policy at George Mason University. He blogs at michaelfauntroy.com, and he was at our headquarters in Washington, D.C. You can find links to their blogs and ours at nprnewsandnotes.org. What if you could climb deep inside the life of a crack-dealing street gang, so deep that you slept on filthy, crack-den floors, the group's kingpin watched your back, and you knew the neighborhood's whole network of prostitutes, upstanding neighbor ladies, and players? As a naive sociology grad student, Sudhir Venkatesh stepped into that world. 7 years later, he started writing about his experience. That story is captured in Sudhir's new book, Gang Leader for a Day, A Rogue Sociologist Takes to the Streets. Sudhir, welcome to News and Notes.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So this book started as a school project. Tell me what you were working on at first.
Well, this was a project of mine for my dissertation as a graduate student, and I just wanted to understand the different attitudes that African-American youth had who were in middle-class neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods and so on. And I was fielding a survey like any good sociologist, and I quickly discovered that the survey, asking people questions and giving them the answers to choose from, was just not the way to learn about social conditions in the urban neighborhoods, or not the best way.
You talk about being inside these virtual walls of the campus, you know, told, okay, don't go into the park alone, don't do this, don't do that. But you went into the park alone. You met some older men. What did they tell you?
A lot of the listeners might who go to schools in big cities might understand that, you know, you get these security maps and they quite literally say, don't cross this street. And of course, the first thing you want to do is cross the street. And I went into Washington Park on Chicago's south side and met some retired African-American men who were spending their days fishing and who really were living history for me. You know, I'd have these books, but they would give me the ins and outs of the black political machine, the state of race relations in the city, and everything that I was reading in these textbooks seemed dead because they could say exactly the same thing with so much more spirit, and I wanted to find a way to spend time with folks like that instead of just asking them a few questions and hoping they could give me short answers.
They basically told you, okay, I'm glad you talked to us, but talk to some younger guys. So what did you do?
So they sent me to a few neighborhoods. I constructed a survey, and I said, okay, let me go see if I can start up some conversations. I went to the Robert Taylor Homes, a very poor public housing development in Chicago, and I walked into the stairwell, and I met this street gang that was selling drugs in the stairwell, and they wondered who I was, and they thought I was a gang member, and they thought I was a Mexican gang member. They started calling me Julio, and I administered the survey to them, and they just laughed. and they thought, okay, you must be from a gang member, another gang, because nobody's going to ask stupid questions like this. They kept me there. And
you
I
had multiple choice questions, like, how do you feel being poor and black?
How do you feel to be black and poor? Exactly.
Yeah, how do you feel now about even asking that question?
As I'm telling you this, I'm shaking my head. And you know, what was really interesting was they gave, the first things that came out of their mouth was, listen, one of the leaders said, I'm not black. You have to understand the difference between Negro, black, African-American. And it gave me this incredible racial classification that I need, you know, and just more and more knowledge was coming from them that I couldn't incorporate in the survey. So I decided to hang out with them as much as I could.
And he said specifically, I'm an N-word. Mm-hmm. How did you feel when he said that?
I was a little taken aback, and I didn't understand why he was saying it. And then he went into the reasons, and it was really that he wanted to signal that he was from the underclass. He was from the poorer sector, the poorer strata of African Americans, and he wanted to differentiate himself from middle class African Americans who had, you know, experienced mobility.
So you met Miss May, who is the mother of a guy you became close to, JT. You spent some time hanging out in her kitchen. How did you see her, and how did you see her son?
So the book is really about this evolving relationship between me and this major street gang leader in the neighborhood, JT. And he would take me around the neighborhood and introduce me to people. And I sort of felt like I was under his thumb. And when he felt it was dangerous or when he felt he didn't want me outside, he'd send me to his mom's house, Ms. May. And she would sit there and she would explain to me, again, a kind of a living history. She would tell me why the projects were built, what it was like for mothers of street gang leaders, how she played a role in this community. I think probably the most important thing I learned from her was the first thing she said to me is, don't pity me. Don't treat me as a victim. I'll take responsibility for life here and what I've done. And she said, don't talk to just the men. Talk to the women. They will tell you a whole different side about life in poor communities.
You did talk to the women, and, you know, you found out a bit about how they earned and saved and shared their money. How did you perceive these gender differences, and what did the women do for the most part?
So if we go back 30, 40 years in public housing, we might remember something called the man in the house rule, and that existed in many poor communities, that women received aid from the government on behalf of their children, and often they had to hide the men who were living in the home. So in places like public housing in the Taylor homes with 30,000 people, 70% were women with children. They were in the public. They were the political voices. And, you know, and the conditions were so bad, the physical conditions, that one apartment, the sink might work, another apartment, the bathroom might work. So five or six families were getting together, showering in one place, cooking in another, and so on. And they developed these extraordinary ties of sharing and support, so that even today, 10 years after some of these families have left and moved out into other parts of Chicago, they still move in networks of five or six families around the city helping each other. It's extraordinary resilience and support in the African-American community.
Now, you hung out with JT, who, much to your surprise, went to college, but you also saw him administer a beatdown to a guy named C-Note. How did that change your perception of him?
For the first 18 months, 2 years, perhaps, I was really under his thumb, you know, and he looked like a ward boss, somebody you'd see in these mafia movies where everyone would know his name. He'd be giving, you know, money to the kids and things like that. And I couldn't get out from under his grip. And one day he didn't see me, and he was punishing the squatter who refused to obey what, you know, he wanted the squatter to take his, he had a car mechanic, little alleyway mechanic operation. He wanted them to take it off the basketball court. The squatter wouldn't do it, and JT beat him up. And I watched him do this. And, you know, just very quickly, any kind of romantic illusion I had about these street gangs was just dispelled because of the immediate ways in which they would resort to violence. And in this community where there was a big underground economy, that's really the side that that was most shocking, was that at any moment things could just explode. It could become very violent, either with people getting beat or, with drive-by shootings and gun violence.
You talk about a guy named Officer Jerry. Who's he and what was he like?
I remember going back and reading the newspaper reports about policing in this in the community when it was being built. And just after 1970 or so, you'd hear police say, this place is too dangerous for us to come into. I mean, imagine a place where the police felt it was too dangerous for them. And those statements happened over and over and over. And what would end up happening is that either police would not come in, or you'd get these kinds of rogue cops these folks like this guy, Officer Jerry, who would come and shake down residents and act really in an unaccountable way. And residents rightly just feared the police because they would experience these sorts of beatings and shakedowns. And I talk about and I describe some of that in the book. And also the ways in which other police officers tried to change the image of policing by doing things more responsibly. So you had a lot of internal divisions within the police and that most of us don't see when we think about some of these inner city communities.
You're teaching now at Columbia. What's the first thing you tell your students to do when they go out in the field?
It's funny, I had a parent of a student call me after the book came out and said, "You're not sending my kid to hang out with crack dealing gangs, are you?" I said, "No, I'm not doing that, but I am telling them that there's a value in stepping outside the ivory tower, going across the street. I send them into Harlem. I send them to the Upper East Side to talk to the rich kids. I really think it's important that we get our students out of the classroom and engaged with people one-on-one, because that is really where I think the fount of knowledge will come from."
Sudhir, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Sudhir Venkatesh is the author of Gang Leader for a Day, A Rogue Sociologist Takes to the Streets. He's also a sociology professor at Columbia University.